welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And we're trying to cover so much content this year. Just due to the fact that we want to get to a point, because my schedule is just going sideways, and there's more and more requests for assistance, and that's a great problem to have. So what we want to do, and actually I'm going to do a review, so you may want to write September 2nd down so that you remember this day regarding content. Because what I want to do is I want to do a review on the content that we've covered. But before we do, that debt is fraud. It's now or never. I covered the obligatories, right? Learn, pray, act. Do I need to remind you the importance of appealing to heaven? Learn, pray, act. Now, it is all about full compliance of the Constitution. I'm telling you, I do not see anyone in D.C. caring about compliance of the Constitution. They're playing the shenanigans of criminal law and civil law instead of constitutional. And I'm using this reference of constitutional law is, in other words, the Constitution being the supreme law of the land. There is really, lawyers have contrived this concept of constitutional law. There's no such thing. The Constitution actually creates its own laws, all based upon the Constitution itself, but the Constitution's being a compact. So in other words, as you create this entity that is able to create law, technically that's federal law. It doesn't mean that it's constitutional law, because the federal government has the ability to create laws for themselves on their own property, i.e. the District of Columbia, military bases, or those things that are under their charge. The states are not under their charge. Now, they can make laws that are in pursuant to the Constitution, which what that means, folks, is when it comes to commerce, they have the ability to regulate specific commerce coming in and commerce going out to foreign nations. But and this is becoming another, I'll just say, there's a bone of contention here that the president doesn't have any say over commerce and our dealings with foreign nations. That is his primary job. Everybody loses sight of this. Oh, the president can't do these tariffs. Absolutely, he can. And as a matter of fact, he could cease and desist all relations with any nation he wants to. That is his prerogative. Now, if he is going to create treaties of trade before Congress can even get involved in regulating that, then he has to create that treaty. I.e., when we were not doing any trades with China. The president had to open those doors and thank Nixon for creating the awesome enemy we get to deal with today. Because we're subsidizing this global war against our Constitution and against ourselves. That's right, folks. We've been subsidizing global communism and global government for years and years. And we've allowed American corporations to actually entrench themselves in this effort. So anyway, as we look at where we are, it is all about constitutional compliance. I've made appeals on this show to the Attorney General Bondi. Why is she even playing with throwing out, you're committing crimes? They're violating their oath in Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, the supreme law of the land. Why is she not removing these people? There's no due. See, this is the problem with lawyers. We got to get, as the Eagle stated, get rid of the lawyers, or maybe it was Don Henley. It was definitely one of Don Henley's songs. Get rid of the lawyers. Get rid of them now. You know, because they are the problem. They want everybody to come into their court like we're a judiciary form of government. How did they take control? Ah, because Congress needed them to be able to move the agenda and get the ball rolling faster. That's why they aggrandize them unconstitutionally. That's why they've let them out of the box. This is one of the reasons why we go through all this content, folks. And so if you listen to this show, you are far smarter on the Constitution, and you can actually see what the heck's going on and how unconstitutional it is compared to all of these people that are just steeping themselves in the grievance industry, or what I'd like to call the conservative entertainment industry. Oh, yeah, there's all these great sound bites, and oh, these are crimes, folks. We do not have to put up with politicians violating their oath. They are to be removed. The supreme law of the land demands it. Okay. So what I wanted to do was I kind of wanted to do a review of what we've covered this year, right? This is the ninth month of the year, which means we've put behind us 8 months. So we're literally in the last trimester of the year, right? That at least, as I look at it, when you do 4 months, 4 months, that's a trimester, right? So we've covered two trimesters of content. And we've really tried to keep it down from the rancor, from from all of these, you know, ancillary comments and so forth. And usually I will take a day like today, September 2nd, write it down, where we cover all of the things, or I'm going to list to you all of the things that we read, whether it be highlights or whether it be the details. We have pointed to you all of the source documents that our government has created and other ancillary documents that I think are absolutely helpful in understanding the paradigm of what the framers created. So there's a lot of people running out there that only want you to listen to, you know, what they want you to hear, because it's targeting very specific emotions and our feelings. You know, when you go to church, you know, you want to hear things that, you know, help resonate, you know, that core belief and build upon that. And so we're literally gravitating towards what I will call political evangelicalism. Because there's people, I want to hear this. This, when you look at where you go to church with, you know, that attracts you, whether it attracts you mentally, whether it attracts you spiritually, socially. There are a lot of people that go to church socially. As a matter of fact, we could talk about, you know, the different, you know, frames of, you know, paradigms between, you know, races, the demographics of people, right, age, so forth, that we can actually see how it has an effect on how we, you know, what appeals to us religiously. It's the same thing with entertainment and art and those types of things. And so, you know, like tattoos, you know, what people do to their body. I remember a long, long time ago, tattooing was a taboo. As a matter of fact, it was considered an evil practice. And look at us today. As a matter of fact, there's not, in our personal lives, we have basically seen almost everybody in the community with tattoos. And we're going, what the heck? Anyway, so I don't want to dive into these personal things. But what I do want to do is I want to remind you that I have a campaign. If you are looking to actually support getting the Electoral College restored, then work with me, because you can actually start petitioning your Secretary of State to say, I want to be on the ballot for being the elector for this congressional district. Because each congressional district gets an elector. Now you can even say, I'd also like to be, you know, be considered for the state, because the state gets two electors, which the state legislature gets. Now, technically, the state legislature should actually get those those electors, but they're not even choosing the electors anymore. They've absconded or actually abdicated their responsibility to the party. So that's my campaign. Focus on the Constitution, full constitutional compliance. We have to start demanding it. I'm telling you, folks, if we actually start demanding at the local level, our politicians are taking an oath, you better keep that oath. And we're watching you. That's our job. That's our role in this constitutional republic. Anyway, we're coming close. We're about a month and a half away from the Microsoft shift. They're no longer going to be supporting your Windows 10. How many people are using Windows 11? None of your data is safe. You're now in a secure web of the globalist technology wizards who have created this ability to now have all of your data. Now, just to be clear, they're the revolving door for government. And when I say government, maybe not necessarily our government, because I can tell you big tech, Google, has been working arm in arm with China, creating their 15-minute cities. I mean, China didn't come up with all this technology on their own. Our technology went in there to help them. I already said this on the show. We've been subsidizing with our technology. This is why all of our big tech is in China. Apple is in China. You love your Apple? They're arm in arm with China too. And it's not about, you know, countries and what do you want to call that? Nationalism. It's not about that. It's about globalism. They're all there to work towards a better world for them to thrive. Not the people that work in the corporations, the elitists that control the corporations. Folks, get your head squared. Get right. You got to start getting right. Anyway, because I'm not going to live forever. And I'd hate to die being the last guy that said all the right things. Now, I know I may say bad things, but I know that there are very specific things you need to hear, and we're going to cover those things because we've been saying them for a long time. Now, this is why when you go and learn history, then you're not learning it the way it lays out so you can see the evolution of America. They're teaching you within microscopic views of certain things that have no bearing on really the true spirit of our constitutional republic. One other thing, by the way, if you're looking for good tech support, I would recommend Next International, I'm sorry. There's a company in Dallas, Next International. Just look up Next International. And the guy I've been working with for years is tech. They provide you Super Micro systems. Look to see if you can get and build an old Super Micro system and put Windows 10 on it if you are looking to get off your Windows 7, because I still have some Windows 7 systems. But bottom line, if you're really looking, because I've been working with these guys for years. They've always made things right. As a matter of fact, I gave away a system that I got in 2006 or 2005, and it's still running to this day. How many of you have computers that are that old, 20 years old, and it's still working as a file share because it has a large repository of terabytes of data? So go to Next International. You can find them online. Tech, T-E-K, he's the guy that can help you. And I'm not getting any money in these endorsements. I'm just telling you, if you're looking for a good, decent computer at a good price, go there. But be aware, it's only going to come with the OS. So in other words, you need to integrate all the things that you want to do to it. And so they give you the great building blocks of a good server or something that will last you longer than you'd ever care to have it take up that space on your desk. I'm telling you this because Big Tech wants you to use your phone and the phone improvements that they're ramming down your throat. They want you to use their phone. Now, here's the interesting thing, and I'm just going to dive into this real quick. Why is it that old phones are no longer supported by the network? Oh, because they know that those old phones, they don't have the ability to track you the way the new phones do. And so they tell you, well, that phone can't all the phones are communicating on the exact same network. They've been able to actually create the ability to block certain, I'll just say, versions of Android or what have you on the phone to where you know that forces you to go that way. Bottom line, your legislatures need to make sure that the phone companies that are operating in your state allow you to maintain that, because it doesn't create more data. It doesn't create a strain on the network. The new phones that have more data or have, I just say, faster data bandwidths and so forth, those are putting the strain on the network. Keeping you on an old phone will actually reduce the amount of data or the clustering and or congestion on the network. So why are they doing this? It's all about control, folks. They want to be able to know where you are, what you're doing, and they want more data on you and more data. There's a reason for all of this, and it's not good, and we don't want to spend the whole show on just diving into that, because I've only got less than 8 minutes, and I want to go through some content here with you. So let's actually cover how smart you are. Let's cover the year so far, all of the topics that we have actually covered for you. Because if you really think about it, folks, by spending your time listening to Sean Hannity, Mark Levin, all of these masterful, rich, well-paid, well-compensated conservative entertainers, along with the mediocrity in the liberal entertainers. I mean, they're just a bunch of hypocrites, and they're like Baghdad Bob. There's no problem. We're all okay. We're winning the war. Well, our tanks are right behind them. Anyway. This is the content that we provided you from the beginning of this year. We covered the Tory acts, and we laid out specifically why this is the first set of documents you have to understand, because this was well before the beginning of the Articles of Confederation and the movement. It was the beginning of the movement of America waking up. What did they do? They actually formed these provincial governments by creating a representative body because they were Englishmen. They had these rights under the Magna Carta and the Bill of Rights because they did not have a representative government. They were seeking representation in Parliament because now they were being taxed and they were claiming no taxation without representation, right? I mean, that was the motto. Had the king just let them have representation and expanded Parliament, but they didn't want to expand Parliament. That would mean that they would have to build a new building. This is what every government does. Your state house, as your state has grown from 100,000 people or 60,000 people when it joined the Union, and you build this monolithic building, and then all of a sudden you bust at the seams in population, did they build a new capital? Did they build a new legislative building to house the adequate number of representatives so that the people could be adequately represented? No. So what do? They reduce your representation. One representative covers more people. Now, there are very few states that are really well represented, like New Hampshire. And I think maybe you could consider the same with Wyoming. But most states are sadly underrepresented. And so this was why what the Supreme Court did with the Baker v. Carr and Reynolds v. Sims rulings made it easier for them to basically obviate this need of maintaining representation for the counties, these counties that were becoming more and more obscured. So the Tory acts really helped lay everything out. We covered that first. I covered the scale of liberty. I kind of covered, and these things are just kind of thrown in there. So this is more of an ancillary or miscellaneous topics. It's not source documents. I talk about the scale of liberty, and I talk about natural law. Natural law was never, there was no source document to say this is natural law, because it was created well before the Tory Acts. It was just kind of an agreed upon paradigm. Madison's essay on property, we covered that as well as we were going through these other documents. The first set of documents that we jumped into after the Tory Acts was the Articles of Association. Tammy and I dove into this, and we basically laid out exactly what they were doing. What we didn't do, and we didn't include it, and I need to actually make a note of that, is the very first petition. Because we actually covered the first petition that Continental Congress sent to the king. We covered it a little bit later, so it's a little disjointed this year. But come to find out, that is a very powerful petition, and it goes hand in hand with the Articles of Association. Both were sent to the king. These were messages to say, we're serious. We're going to do these very specific things, and we're all on board with getting rid of slavery and doing these things. Which actually, when you really look at the Articles of Association, how they took a stance against slavery, and then all of a sudden, a few years later, when they create the Articles of Confederation, slavery's off the table. Oh, we're going to keep it. That's when the South really started recognizing, you know, we can't go down this path. But they still had to walk this very thin line because they needed to break away from Britain. So they actually willingly gave up their slaves. And that became problematic. And we cover all these types of stuff. But anyway, so we covered the very first petition to the king. And then we dove into the Articles of Confederation. From the Articles of Confederation, we actually covered the amendments. So in other words, there were a bunch of amendments to the Articles of Confederation. We read all of them. So we went through to show you how inept and how problematic the Articles of Confederation were. Then we dove into the meetings that were leading, because the Articles of Confederation could not get amended. In 1783, when they were ratified, by 1785, the colonists started meeting, or I should say the states by this point in time, because we actually covered the treaty as well. I didn't cover the treaty at that point. I covered it a little later. But the Treaty of Versailles, which is considered the Treaty of 1783 with Britain, we actually read that. We went through that. And everybody tells you that there's, see, that's where we were still subjects. No, that's not. As a matter of fact, I have to laugh at how many people point to these documents and say it was in the, because nobody bothers to read them. Folks, these people, there are people out there, sovereign citizens movement, general assembly movements, and so forth, they are lying to you. And what they use actually is funny. They actually go and they use court cases, because I know the General Assembly, I remember going through, you know, how they justified themselves. There was an obscure ruling in, I don't know, Kentucky or Tennessee, some place in the, you know, the west, or the initial Western expanse, where this concept of the General Assembly was maintained by a judge. A judge said, yeah, you can do that. Hold on here. You can't do that, judge. You can't basically, we can't create this new framework of government where we have a three branches of government. In other words, we take the magistrate, we get rid of the magistrate, or we actually divide it into a legislative, executive, and judiciary. And then all of a sudden, he's going to allow these jural assemblies to actually start forming and, you know, undermine their own representative government. So, when I read those documents, the documents that are being cited are court cases. So, when we come back, we will get back into this long line of documents that goes through our evolution, getting into the Constitution, and then, well, we'll cover the whole thing when we come back. Again, this is all September 2nd. You want to write this day down, because this is how you can show people how smart you can be by spending time listening to the radio.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so I'm going through the list of the content we cover for you, because nobody's doing this for you. You can't go to school and dive into these documents. Everybody wants to keep you marginally informed so that you know what they want you to know, so that you will act the way they need you to act, right? They know that old people are going to have a bad-based paradigm because you don't use First Amendment petitions. Why is that? Because they made sure they didn't teach you about the First Amendment petition. They actually started telling you, and as a matter of fact, when the court cases started ruling regarding protest, if you really look at it, during the civil rights demonstrations, because by this point in time, we the people did not understand the First Amendment petition, because people were just letting government do whatever they were doing, causing problems with the blacks, causing problems with different demographics, and everybody else. People saw the injustice, but they didn't do anything. Nobody really did anything. Well, you know, and nobody really, I can't say that nobody, because the abolition movement and the civil rights movement was alive and well. As a matter of fact, the only time in history of America where racial relationships were actually reasonable was around the 1920s. As a matter of fact, in President Lyndon B. Johnson's speech, he actually talks about how the racial, the financial differences between a black family and a white family were pretty marginal, the average family. Because everybody had jobs, there were plenty of people that were invested and so forth. And so from that point on, from the crash of the market to the time he became president, all of a sudden things got bad for the blacks. Oh, well, yeah, because the market had crashed. And what did America do? America created the projects. Hoover, being the first president who inherited the crash, created the projects for blacks because, you know, we needed to do something for them so that we could keep them in one location. And this is when the Negro Project was brought forward with FDR, putting Planned Parenthood close to the projects. In other words, there was a systemic, and there's lots of people that dive into this, so I don't want to dwell on this too long, but the fact of the matter is that nobody understands all of these things that really transpired in America to where nobody was using First Amendment petitions. Nobody. And so when the civil rights really started steeping up, and I forget whether it was 61, I think it was 62 or 3, where there was actually a petition, or I should say a court case. And the court case was a ruling that the mob that actually assembled on a government property was considered a First Amendment right. Not a right of petition, not a right of protest, but a First Amendment right of speech. They obviated, and actually, they should have actually cited that the people needed to actually formulate petitions because government has a responsibility to receive and respond. But instead, they obviated by basically saying, yeah, go ahead and do that. And from that first case on, there's been case after case after case where they expanded the right. Because just remember, that very first case was on government property where there's no right of commerce. You're right there. I mean, this is not where people go and sell products. The only people that are being affected when you basically block access on government property is the government. Those people who aren't producing anything, they're actually taking. So, the irony, right? So, when we look at, you know, what they were doing, they were basically getting you away from stopping them doing the critical work of taking away your liberties. Get you out into the street. Start affecting business. There you go, so that they can come in and as you decimate your towns, because this is exactly what happened in the 2020 riots. They decimated towns and somebody came in and bought up all that property that got burnt down. And Catherine Austin Fitz is entertaining you with all these evils that they're doing. And nobody is teaching you what you need to be doing and how we actually have effective ways of dealing with our government. Oh, it's good to know all of this stuff. I say no. If you really want to change government, you have to be smart on how to deal with government based on the law. The Constitution gives us the right of assembly and First Amendment petition to petition government for the redress of grievances. They actually go hand in hand. And it's the same thing with instruction. We have a right. It's hand in hand with the petition because in the petition, we're instructing them. You can't do these things. Because guess what, folks? The lobbyists and all the people that have completely perverted our government has convinced them this is how government works. Because they've been here all the time. You guys come and go. We're the ones that maintain the stability to ensure that the machine is moving in the direction it needs to go. Your county commissioners would get that same crap. And this is how we do things here. No. No, no, no. We've got a constitutional crisis. It's not like, you know, the cost of wheat out of the entire market of food. The cost of wheat has gone up a little. No, they've been waging economic warfare by subsidizing, by getting us not to produce food, to where our whole food system and our strategic need of survival is being threatened. How is that not a constitutional crisis? The fact that they're spraying, I could just go on and on. So let me just calm down. I get myself out of this hole. So we covered that very first petition. We covered all of those details that kind of led into that revolution and the Articles of Confederation. And we also covered the amendments to the Articles of Confederation. And so then we dove into, obviously, because they could amend the Articles of Confederation, they said, we need to fix that. That's one thing we need to fix. And as a matter of fact, I find it ironic that the John Birch Society goes around and says, it was a runaway convention because they made that change. That was one of the major problems they had to fix. And yet, when they go into the U.S. Constitution, the U.S. Constitution, because they wanted the ability for the states to be able to actually make amendments to the Constitution, actually make changes, those changes cannot take effect. But they will if a law, as long as 3/4 of the states buy into it. The unanimity had to be broken. Everybody agreed the unanimity had to be broken. Only the few anti-federalists that wanted to maintain their cabals, and that's why the Constitution was actually ratified. So why is it that the John Birchers actually want to take the anti-Constitution position? They actually argue the anti-constitutional position like we're idiots. But anyway, let me continue. So they set up the delegates, and then finally we dove into the Constitutional Convention. So Tammy and I went through the Constitutional Convention, and then we dove straight into, actually, Tammy and I drove straight into the ratification debates. But some of the other things that we covered, one of the things I covered was the remonstrance on religious assessments, right? I know I covered why Madison did what he did in trying to help open everybody's eyes to the importance of not allowing government to choose sides when it comes to Christianity. There's nothing wrong with states being Christian, or there's nothing wrong with within the state of actually establishing a religion. You got to remember that when you look at the 14th Amendment, the 14th Amendment ensured that no person's privileges or no U.S. citizen's privileges and immunities can be abridged. Is the establishment of a religion actually abridging your right? As long as that religion does not hamper your ability to proselyte, to speak, to, you know, go around and speak otherwise. In other words, as long as your religious expressions and your worship are not hindered in any way, they can have that. And why would the state have a state-sponsored religion? Because back in the days, eight states at the time of the Constitutional Convention ratified, and moving forward, eight states actually had state-sponsored churches. And that's how they took care of the education system in their state. That's how they took care of medicine. That's how they took care of compassionate service. The churches were better equipped, and the framers wanted to make sure that the churches maintained that relationship with the people, that they only worried about the business of the day and making sure the people had, you know, being unfettered by government to be able to go and do what they needed to do to survive. You know, go start a business. And every family actually was family business. That term family business goes all the way back to that point in time. That's one of the reasons why they had big families, to get the children to be able to do the work. Oh, yeah, they were really inhumane, because they taught the children responsibilities of how to grow food and how to work and, you know, get up in the morning and go milk the cow at very young ages. As soon as they were capable of taking on responsibility, that's why America was great, because everybody understood they had responsibilities and they participated. We didn't have a homeless problem. When you actually take and say, you don't have to work, when you hear somebody tell a child that they don't have to work, they're enabling bad behavior. There is nothing better than a society that is fully self-sufficient. And how do you get that way? It's not by enabling people not to do things. So some of the other topics that we covered while Tammy and I were going through, the Constitutional Convention, Tammy and I covered the Organic Act. Before we got into the Constitutional Convention, we dove into the Organic Act, the Treaty of 1871 with Britain. And I actually thought that there was something there, but there really wasn't anything there, because the U.S. government, come to find out, the U.S. government was actually doing things all on their own in assuming and taking away state sovereignty. Whether they've had this moral, appeal to say, you guys need the help and we're going to help you. Well, as Madison stated, if they're going to help you, you have to delegate that ability to help you. Because if they do it, they don't have the authority. It's being done unconstitutionally. And so at any point in time, people can actually wake up and say, you know what? You can't do this. You had no authority to do this. Shut it down. Because we haven't covered it yet, but we will cover the three presidential vetoes of the Department of Transportation. That's critical. Because if they can't create a Department of Transportation because three presidents said you can't, you need to amend the Constitution to do it, then where did they get the authority to create the Department of Education and the rest of these things? This concept went out, and as a matter of fact, I harassed Glenn Beck over this. And come to find out, Glenn Beck got the word on it, and he never made any point of it. It's very sad, very, very sad. So anyway, as I look forward to what we covered on my own, I covered the Definitive Treaty of Paris of 1783 after, you know, we started covering all these other things, i.e. the Constitutional Convention. So during the Constitutional Convention with Tammy and I, on Fridays and Mondays, started covering other content. The Definitive Treaty of Paris of 1783, we also covered the Louisiana Purchase. We also covered the Treaty of Ghent, the Treaty of Hidalgo. We also covered the Enabling Act of Utah. And I also covered other enabling acts that were critical to help show and prove to you, I believe, Indiana, Mississippi. I don't think we got into Illinois, but I know I proved to you how they were using the Northwest Ordinance to actually start taking state powers and state sovereignty away from them. So we dove into the Northwest Ordinance as well. Another document somewhere along the line, I included Madison's notes. Oh, no, that's, I think I included Madison's essay on property. So a part of this, in addition, another little ancillary, you know, day I took off to and kind of cover this on a regular basis, the uniqueness of American republicanism, something that I have to emphasize this. This is why I bring it up quite a bit. In American republicanism, so what is a republican form of government? It's representative and the rule of law. In other words, the law is the king, or unless you have a monarchy, then you have a king, then you have a representative monarchy, right? It's still a representative or republican monarchy. Britain was a republican monarchy and a theocracy as well. So when you look at the type of government, it's not just one thing. It can be multiple things. And today, we don't have a republican form of government. We have a corporate judiciary party, and what's the other one? Let me see. Party, corporate, judiciary. There's another one out there. Oh, the banking. So we have multiple controls, multiple masters that are dictating our everyday life. It's not the constitutions. And so, as an aside, I get involved in local groups. And down in Southern California, there's a group called Real Impact. And or over in Southern California, there's a group called Real Impact. And they're fighting this assault on the family. And the problem in dealing with this, and I'm going to get into the details as we move through this, that they're focused on the morality and the frontal assault on the family, saying, you can't do this. This is wrong. You're taking away our rights. But they're not placing it in context to the Constitution. They have to place context to the Constitution to say, where in the Constitution were you delegated the authority to do this, 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 and this? That right there is a legal argument based on the law. If you don't do that, then you're going to lose the argument, because if you tell them this is just wrong, so what? You haven't proven that we can't do it. Why would you make the argument over moralities and platitudes instead of a legal argument to say this is clearly a violation? That's why we cover all these types of things. But folks, it frustrates me when I deal with anybody regarding Georgia. I got involved with a group in Georgia last year, and I showed them, go read your constitution. They don't have the authority to do these things. And some of the things they're doing are direct violations of the Constitution. California, so interestingly enough, California violates the U.S. Constitution left and right. But the one thing they actually amended, this is the first state that I've actually seen legitimately empower the state to create a minimum wage. Washington State doesn't have the power to do it, and yet they have one. Every state in the union has a minimum wage from the, you know, Minimum Wage Act of the federal government back in the 60s. Well, hold on here. That's not law. That's not something within the Constitution. That's why I said earlier in the show, I pointed out that Congress can create two types of laws. Laws that are effective in their land and in their sphere. They can create a minimum wage for the District of Columbia and the minimum wage of any employees that they have to hire on military bases or what have you. Only federal property that are absolutely allowed within the Constitution. They can't maintain territories. Their job with the territory is to have a plan, and actually the states really need to you know, if the convention of states ever really cared about actually giving us real constitutional convention, or I should say not real, real amendments that will actually fix problems, we need to go through and clarify and actually stipulate that the Constitution never gave them the ability to, you know, manage territories permanently, or when they managed the territory and brought them into the Union, to subjugate them. They're the child. The child had the responsibility of preparing the territory to become the adult. In other words, it was kind of like the nursery. The federal government was literally just a nursery responsibility. It was a stewardship of helping that land get organized on its own to become a sovereign state and an equal partner to the parents. And yet, they actually got away with, I mean, they're getting away with killing us because of our ignorance on the Constitution. So, let me get back into this. So I covered American republicanism, then I dove into some of the documents that came out of that Utah Enabling Act, the Preemption Act of 1841. Covered that one. We covered other enabling acts. I covered the Northwest Ordinance at that point in time as well. And I showed to you why the Northwest Ordinance was superseded by the Constitution. It was dead. It had no bearing, and yet they realized if they would resurrect the Northwest Ordinance and use it to apply to states, it empowered them over the states. But the Constitution, again, superseded. And any person out there, because I know they got a good, they're very noble, religious, and good Christians, and what have you, but they still elevate the Northwest Ordinance over the Constitution, and they're trying to tell you that's legitimate, they're lying to you. And if they don't understand the dangers of the Northwest Ordinance, because Continental Congress had all control. This was Continental Congress's, you know, one-time shot of controlling a very specific area, a very specific territory, the Northwest Territory, and how they were going to bring them into the Continental Congress or into this union of the Confederacy, because they had no authority to do it, so they had to create this contract or the compact. That compact died, and the United States, under the Constitution, assumed all authority. And it literally delegated a very specific process of how states would be admitted, ignoring the entire Northwest Ordinance. The Constitution was ratified in 1788. The Northwest Ordinance was ratified in 1787. Ergo, the Constitution superseded all of those Continental Congress laws. Therefore, this has become really problematic, and the Western lands and the Home Department started getting formulated in 1789. Under these Articles of Confederation, no, under the United States Constitution, they actually started organizing in how, so we covered these things, because I actually went through the first debates of the very first session of Congress. And in there was no subjugating at all. It was basically getting everything ready and the importance of stimulating sales, property sales, so that there would be enough people moving into the territory to transition it into a state. So because Congress can actually sell land while it is a territory, they sold the land. When they became a state, the state took, and it was supposed to take, full ownership. Over time, Congress didn't give that up, and the Constitution mandates that it does, because when you read, and this is why we go through the Constitution, we read this stuff. In Article 4, Section 3, it is very clear that when a state becomes a state, the federal government cannot create a claim that would prejudice the sovereignty of a state to say you can't be sovereign. They can't do that. That's why it literally says they have the power to make needful rules and regulations for the territory, not the state. All those things that they created, all the laws, everything else, goes out the window when the state creates its own constitution, its own government. Period. That's it. And that was the intent. Every state, that's why we went through the Constitutional Convention as well, because they literally laid out this whole concept of equal footing. Anyway. We kept on covering more and more data, i.e., I went through the 1820 April 24 Act, making further provisions for the sale of public land. And this right there was based on setting up a Ponzi scheme where they started demanding states actually give them a half a million acres so they can sell it. And the proceeds, 2%, a paltry 2% of the proceeds went to actually building these trails, establishing trails to get in and out of the state to go to D.C. It's not like they were building super highways and railroads and everything else. Railroads hadn't even come along yet. So they actually pulled a quick one over the state's eyes. What happened to the rest of the money? Well, a lot of that money went to actually bolstering Washington, D.C., or the District of Columbia, so it would be, so they'd have schools, so they could create their own little civil society and work their way into statehood, which was absolutely unacceptable to the framers, that it would be even a part of a state. It needed to maintain full autonomy. No state, no electoral college, no representation in Congress, nothing. It was a seat of government that could not be encumbered by the states. That's it. Not a state upon itself. A seat of government. Okay. And I'm here to tell you, folks, that they don't need all that land. And I'm here to tell you that we actually should probably disassemble the District of Columbia and go to needful buildings and start distributing those needful buildings across the Union. That's right. Why would we want to have everything co-located so that you just drop a bomb and it cripples us? That's not a good strategic design. It was great back, you know, back in the day when you had to have everything localized because technology couldn't allow you to expand like this. Anyway, we also covered the land acts that created the public lands. In other words, how the surveyors were out there doing, you know, the surveying, moving chains and the charges and all of that. Remember, that was just not too long ago. We also covered Jackson's Regulating the Deposits of Public Money, an act that he actually got Congress to establish a federal bank. The Congress and the federal government became the banking system of America. And what they were going to do is they're going to take all this surplus money from Madison's plan of paying off the debt. Well, they had all this money coming in. So instead of saying, hey, America, we're not going to tax you anymore, they created the monster of a federal bank. Do you understand why they taught you that Jackson got rid of the bank charter? Yeah, what he did is he federalized the bank. He made it a part of the federal government. So as we kind of move down this path of Andrew Jackson doing this, the next step that we're going to read, that I'm going to get into, not today, but I'll be getting into this, the Martin Van Buren special message of selling this idea, because everybody was kind of scratching their heads going, hold on here. The federal government, that was argued a long time ago. At least I'm thinking that there was pushback. I don't have any artifacts to tell you that, but the fact is, if Martin Van Buren had to make a special message the following summer, 23rd of June of 1737, or 1837, regulating public money, I'm telling you that they were pulling the wool over eyes here, because Jackson just passed this act, and then they went into this. So, folks, as I've listed all of these things, that's what we've covered already. So what I will do, because I'll probably either do this tomorrow or I'll do this in the next break, cover the rest of the stuff we're covering for the rest of this year. If you listen to this show, you will start getting smart on all of these key documents. September 2nd, write this day down. I'm G.R. Mobley, we're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.